Hey, Chris.
Daniel Coyle, how are you?
I'm pretty fine. How are you doing?
I'm good. Is that literary pretty fine?
Pretty fine. Pretty fine. It's more CB radio than anything else. So
right.
Real fine. Real fine. That's growing up on Kachemak Bay. That was kind of the lingo there, listening to some of our neighbors. That's real fine.
I loved having that life of CB radio, and my dad always had a CB in the truck, and we would get on it and goof around, and then there's always somebody that would say, okay, you kids, get off this radio. We know, and they'd always say, we know where you are, and we would get wide-eyed and look at each other like, oh my God, they know where we are. No, they don't. But it never failed to stop us from monkeying around on the CB.
That's awesome. It was such a good community thing. Everybody, you know, you just kind of had a connection with everybody. It was so nice.
People probably like that you come from Alaska. It's still a little bit like coming from a foreign country, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. I mean, it helps in kind of connecting to people, but it also helps in kind of looking at things from a different angle, which is useful from a writer's point of view all the time. Like, there's an easy way to see things or a default way of seeing things, and then there's an angle, and Alaska gives you a lot of angles.
And growing up here probably has influenced or informed at least how you observe the world, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like anybody in Alaska, the lower 48 seems strange and exotic. You know, we had relatives in Illinois and Missouri. And whenever we went to see them, it was like going to another planet, you know, in every way, you know, in the kind of customs of eating, you know, corn on the cob in certain ways and certain way you'd spend your time. And it just was incredibly exotic. And if I lived there, I'm sure I'd never would have had that same sort of, you know, perspective.
Corn on the cob, not coming underneath cellophane on top of styrofoam. It's like, wait a minute, you got that
exactly,
fresh?
Exactly. You get to take it, and then you get a kind of a lot of debate over the best ways to put the butter on. That's very local custom. It's like going to Papua New Guinea or something.
I took the culture quiz at danielcoyle.com, and I took the culture quiz, and I'm proud to report to you, Daniel, that I have strong culture. At my company, I have strong culture. And it occurred to me, as the leader, the boss, the broker of this company, I'm probably the last person that should be taking that quiz, right?
That's right. It is. It's definitely graded on a curve, depending on where you're at. And I think you have to get everybody's input to figure out where the whole group is at. It's kind of an attempt to measure how the group is doing.
So your book, The Culture Code, is fantastic. And I told you once before, I think it should be required reading for any elected political official and or government worker, anybody that is within any institution, truly, be it public or private. I really think this should be required reading, The Culture Code. So why did you, Daniel Coyle, why did you start looking at culture? What prompted that? I'm assuming it's some sort of an offshoot from another endeavor, but why culture?
Yeah, it's like as a writer, you're always looking for big mysteries. And the big mystery that I kept encountering, you know, I'd spent a fair amount of time writing and reporting on this kind of performance space, like why people are good at stuff. And so I found myself in places where, you know, people were really good at stuff, whether that was chess or art or dance. And you know that feeling you have, and you have it, you know, all the time in Alaska, where you walk into a place and the place feels kind of special, and you just get a good vibe from that. It might be the Two Sisters Bakery. It might be, you know, a certain teacher's classroom at the high school, the elementary school, where there's just kind of a good vibe, you know, and we have a way of thinking about those places like, oh, they have good chemistry or we have good culture. And I kept bumping into that mystery of like, what's going on in those places? Why are they so warm and attractive and high performing and successful? And that is same as same as true when it comes to a successful business. You walk in a successful restaurant, you walk in, you can feel it, right? What's that made of? It feels like magic, but it's not magic. It's a thing. And if it's a thing, it can be measured. And if it can be measured and studied, then I'm really curious about it. So, I sort of spent, you know, a fair amount of time, you know, visiting these places and looking at the science that seeks to explain what those kind of dynamics are, both the science of mostly psychology. And it comes down to these places are behaving in certain ways, the behaviors that send signals that create that connection. And so that was kind of the, you know, like any good book, it always starts with a mystery that's right in front of your nose. And that was a mystery that was right in front of my nose. Like, why is that place so cool? Why is that place so magnetic? And I visited enough of those places, and they were, you know, like SEAL Team 6 and Pixar and the San Antonio Spurs and all these groups that that have had success in creating the kind of magnetically successful groups that we all look up to. So the book was kind of an attempt to X-ray that and say, hey, here's what it's made of.
I put your work, Dan. I put your work at the top of the pile, along with writers and researchers like Dan O'Reilly, Malcolm Gladwell, Robert Greene, and I think what you're doing is shining a light on the wonder of humanity and why we matter. And it's not just research and data. With your books, and I'd include the Talent Code along with the Culture Code, you tell a beautiful story along the way. So I really believe, I know you say there's no magic in culture, it can be codified, but I believe there's magic in your writing. It's really, I think it's your writing is at a level that you draw people in that maybe didn't even know they wanted to read research. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I appreciate you saying that, and it does not look like magic on my end, I can assure you. It looks much more like a really hard house building project somewhere out on East End Road, you know, where it's like, yeah, there's a lot of Tyvek up, a lot of Typar on the ground. Things are, you know, they're trying to make things fit. So the end process, what comes out of it, a lot of people kind of tend to think that writing is like taking dictation from God. And that is definitely not the case with me. It's more like carpentry, and I'm a pretty slow carpenter. And so it's not, the end product is polished, but the process is not.
Why did the Cleveland Indians call you, of all people in the world? Why did they call Dan Coyle?
I mean, I'd written this book about how to get good at stuff, and that it found an audience in the sports community, and there were some coaches for the Indians who were using it, and so they looked in the back flap and they saw that it said that, you know, Dan Coyle spends the school years in Cleveland and then, you know, the summers in Alaska, and they gave me a call. So I got a kind of a call out of the blue from these instructors, these coaches there, and one thing led to another. I ended up having lunch with, and they're an interesting team because they're in a small market, one of the smallest in all of pro sports. They can't afford to buy their talent. They have to build it and grow it, and you know, can't sign a free agent. You have to build a good player. And so they're keenly interested, you know, they're kind of operate like a baseball school. They're trying to get the very most out of every hour and create really a ton of learning. And so that's what kind of drew it to me, because, you know, baseball, like anything super traditional, they have a lot of habits that they do just because Babe Ruth did them that way. For example, batting practice, you know, before every game, they have a person, you're my age, throwing batting practice, and everybody hits home runs. And, you know, it makes them feel comfortable and it's fun. But does it make you better? That was the question that I was kind of asking them, like, is there a better way to do that? And so they were big, obvious questions that, you know, no magic in them at all, but they were kind of ripe to, look at their sport, look at their habits, look at their coaching from a new perspective. And that's what, that's kind of the perspective that I was provided, that I've been providing for the last 7 years now.
There are some critical signals that you've identified and sort of codified in the book Culture Code. And one of the signals is safety. And I think that's interesting. Explain, what do you mean? Because some people will say, well, I need a safe space or whatever. But what right. do you mean safety right. is a critical signal to a good culture?
Yeah, because, you know, we got these really old brains between our ears. And they have evolved over millions of years. And they are super sensitive to asking, they're continually asking really simple questions in all of our social relationships. Do I share a future with these people? You know, we have this sort of wiring that is always worried about our situation. And so groups that do create strong connection are really, really good at behaviors and sending behavioral signals that are, they function as belonging cues. They're called belonging cues. And they're short, simple behaviors that say, hey, I see you, I care about you, and we share a future. And so that sense of safety that those signals establish is the kind of foundation for everything that a group does. If you destroy that sense of safety, in many ways, you destroy the group. That's not to say, by the way, that other techniques of kind of creating culture don't exist. I mean, there are, you know, you have cultures that are built around establishing fear, and fear works. It absolutely works. It works for a little while, and it works on really simple problems. But if you're looking to have something sustain, and navigate complex problems, you've just got to create safety. There's no two ways around it. You cannot govern through fear.
Another critical signal or belonging cue would be shared risk or mutual vulnerability. So is this where the CEO kind of breaks down and cries at a sales meeting? Or what does that mean? Shared risk. Talk about that.
You'll have to try that at your next meeting.
Oh, I do every meeting.
Sharing risk and sharing vulnerability is really built on some really simple truths, which is the only way that we have of conveying accurate information is by really sharing risk, by actually having what's called a vulnerability loop where both people are being open. And when you do have two people who are sort of being open with each other, you end up creating a ton of, you know, cohesion and cooperation and chemistry. And you know, when groups and people are hiding stuff from each other, it doesn't go so well. When they're open with each other, it does. Being vulnerable is kind of, but it doesn't always mean sort of emotionality. It doesn't always mean breaking down and crying at your meeting. It can be as simple. I heard a really cool story the other day from an engineer, software engineer, and he used to work at Pixar. And one day he's a young guy at Pixar and the boss comes around to watch him work. And the boss is named Ed Catmull, and he's one of the most brilliant people in the business. He founded the company with Steve Jobs. So the big boss is standing there watching them work. And at the end of the conversation, the boss, Ed, comes over and says to this young engineer, hey, when you guys are done, could you come up to my office and teach me how to do that? And the guy who told me this story got goosebumps. It happened like 15 years ago, and he got goosebumps telling me about it because it was such a cool moment. And I'd say what Ed was doing there was creating a vulnerability loop. He was admitting he didn't know something, and he was expressing interest and engagement in learning it, and then inviting this young engineer into his office to take the power position of teaching it to him, to the boss. So that's the kind of moment that smart leaders are always creating, where they're not sort of folding their arms and saying, I got all the answers. They're using little sort of on-ramps to let people step up. And people are so kind of authoritarian minded, the reflex is never to do that. So it's actually incumbent on the leader to like make that happen by saying, hey, I might be wrong here. I want to really explore this opportunity with you. And I screwed up. One of the guys that I interviewed for the book was a Navy SEAL commander. He actually trained the troops that captured and killed bin Laden. And the way he put it was, he said, the most important words a leader can say are, I screwed that up. And that's what he's talking about. He's talking about, like, if you have leaders who are willing to say, I screwed that up, who are willing to say, hey, come teach me that, you end up creating these kind of vulnerability loops, these real conversations where people aren't hiding from each other, but they're sharing accurate information. And that's what you got to do if you want to have a group that performs well.
And I think it's important to point out that we're talking about primarily business or maybe governmental at this stage of our conversation, but really one could apply everything you just mentioned to family in a familial situation whereby dad or mom or the authority figure does just what you described there. I think it's really fascinating. And safety, of course. You need to feel safe in
totally.
Your family.
Yeah, right. And there's a funny sort of thing that one of the leaders I interviewed sort of taught me. He said, you know, that conversation you have with your kids every night, you come home, you sit down, and you ask that question that every parent asks. And you know the question, Chris. I mean, the question is like, how was your day? Right? And that question, it never leads to anything. Like it's never led to a good conversation in human history. So instead, the suggestion was, instead of asking them how their day, you should share something that you screwed up at that day, something you messed up at, and share that and kind of start there rather than from the authoritative, I want you to inform me on how your day went, to sort of share a funny story where you something you screwed up at. Yeah. And it's like, okay, that kind of makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. And then the third cue I want to chat with you about is story and common goal, having a common goal, but being able to wrap that commonality in a story that's memorable, actionable, and informs both shared risk and safety at the same time. So how important is story?
Yeah, it's sort of like, it's how we find our way. It's like GPS, you know, the world is this really distracting place. It's probably more distracting now than it ever has been in human history with these devices we're carrying around and all the information. So how do good groups know where True North is? How do they navigate that? And the answer is, as you said, through story, no pun intended. You know, having a really, really clear, you know, image, story, tension, True North that you talk about, that you embody in artifacts, that you continually create conversations about, that you clearly prioritize. The metaphor that I think is most appropriate is filling the windshield. Yeah, good leaders are continually over communicating, filling the windshield with these really vivid images, stories, a lot of corny catchphrases, like a lot of really, really the SEALs are the worst. You know, you would think that these people are confident. You'd think that they wouldn't talk continually about what their purpose is, but they do. They always talk about the only easy day was yesterday, and we shoot, move, and communicate, and we're the quiet professionals. I mean, they talk all the time about how they're the quiet professionals. They kind of can't shut up about how quiet they are. But it is it's part of what makes a good culture to create this conversation that is about continually gesturing toward and spotlighting this. What's the narrative? What are we here for? Where are we headed? What's good and what's bad? And being able to do that is for good leaders. It's kind of like you're always composing a song or something. You know, you're always continually trying to grab good stories and put them in front of the group. And show them what great looks like and what bad looks like.
Daniel, I do want to say, too, I have to thank you before I let you go. I have to say thank you because I want to say it was about 2008, maybe, when you were just getting ready to go on a nationwide tour of the Talent Code. We went to lunch together. I paid. Anyway, we went to lunch together, and you had said, based on what I wanted to hear from you, I really wanted to hear more about your Talent Code, and somebody had suggested that we meet because I was starting this on Top of the World Radio, a very purpose-driven radio endeavor, and you said to me, based on our conversation, you really need to go research Dr. Martin Seligman, and I did, mm-hmm. and I've become a massive fan of his positive psychology, so I have to say thank you for that. It was worth the lunch.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm glad to be of help there, Chris. It's always fun chatting with you.
It's like 12 bucks or something. Well, come on, it's 8 years. Let's forget about that I paid for the lunch, and let's just move on from there. Thank you, Daniel.
Good stuff. Hey, thank you, Chris. Really.
That's life. That's life. That's what all the people say. You're riding high in April, shot down in May. But I know I'm gonna change that tune. When I'm back on top in June. I said that's life. And as funny as it may seem, some people get their kicks stomping on a dream. But I don't let it get me down. 'Cause this fine old world, it keeps spinning around. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out, and I know one thing. Each time I find myself flat on my face, I pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life.
That's life.
I tell you, I can't deny it. I thought of quitting, baby, but my heart just ain't gonna buy it. And if I didn't think it was worth one single try, I'd jump right on a big bird and then I'd fly. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out, and I know one thing. Each time I find myself laying flat on my face, I just pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life. But if there's nothing shaking come this here July, I'm gonna roll myself up in a big ball and